Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We are in Joshua chapter 2, and this is where Joshua sends spies across the Jordan to check out Jericho. They end up at Rahab's house. The king ends up finding about him, the king of Jericho. He comes to Rahab's house thinking that she knows something. She must be a source of information. And she sends them off the wrong direction. She lets the spies out the window. They go to the west. They hide out and meet Joshua back across the Jordan at the three-day mark. So what we've got here, very quickly, I've got several pictures to look at, some interesting things. Here's the Jordan River. There's the top of the Dead Sea. Jericho is right about here. Over here is the camp. It's at a place called Shittim, which is also, we'll take a look at this, also a place today called Tal El-Hamam, Hamam, which is a place that was also known most likely as Sodom. Joseph knew about it, that place right here. They're camped right here. They're about 7 miles from the border. Joshua's told them they've got 3 days, get ready, in 3 days we're going. We're going to assume that same day that he sends out in chapter 1 the message to the tribes that they're going to get ready. We're going to be leaving in 3 days. He also sends spies across the Jordan with two things, to check out Jericho and the land. The fact that they've only got 3 days means they're not going to be able to go through the whole land. The focus is going to be Jericho. So they're going to be here in Jericho. The day he sends them out is probably the day they arrive. They go to Rahab's house or Rahab's inn, where Rahab's got a place, a tavern, an inn, someplace. Travelers come and go. She's got a place in the wall, on the wall. And so probably a lot of travelers are coming and going. The day that they get there in her place, that they find out about the spies somehow. They're sent secretly, but yet they're found out. Probably because Joshua and the Israelites are camped right here. I mean, thousands of them are right there, and they know they're heading their direction. They've already conquered territory over here, so they're probably watching them. They have saw them coming. And for some reason, again, we'll talk about it, they go to Rahab's house. The spies then are sent out by Rahab after she sends the king's men. She sends them, she says, quick, quick, they just left. And they probably then try to trace them back, track them back to Jericho, assuming they're going back to the camp. She sends them to the hills that are just to the west, or mountains, if you want to call them that, and says, stay there for 3 days. As Joshua's getting ready, he's heading this way. After 3 days, the spies are heading back. They ford the Jordan and probably meet right back there with their report. So that's the way this is all going to go down. I'm going to read this, just give the background, then we're going to look at a few pictures and maps that I've got there in the notes. And then we'll just go through here and point out a few things that are in chapter 2 of Joshua. Chapter 2 of Joshua, verse 1. Then Joshua, son of Nun, secretly sent two spies from Shittim. And that's right there, Shittim, 7 miles east of the Jordan. Go look over the land. Now, again, when he says the land, he doesn't mean, you know, the whole land. I don't think so, because Joshua's already been a spy, and they'd spent 40 days checking out the land, especially Jericho. So they went and entered the house of a prostitute named Rahab and stayed there. The king of Jericho was told, look, some of the Israelites have come here tonight to spy out the land. So the king of Jericho sent this message to Rahab. Maybe they saw them go in. Maybe they recognized them as, you know, an Israelite people. They know they're at Rahab's house. Bring out the men who came to you and entered your house, because they have come to spy out the whole land. What's interesting is they're not accusing Rahab. Rahab suffers no consequences for this. It's not like she's betraying them. They're not suspicious of her. People are coming and going. This is the likely place people would go, is this place on the wall and in a place of travelers, a tavern. But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. Notice she, ahead of time, before the men of the king come, you know, the doorbell doesn't ring. She goes, quick, 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 we got to hide. She's already hidden them when they come. In other words, maybe she saw something suspicious. I mean, she seems to be, as this whole story unfolds, a fairly sharp woman. One, the king comes to her for information. The men, the spies, come to her.
meaning there's people coming and going. She anticipates the whole situation. She's ahead of time. And she's going to have a great confession, knowing thoroughly in detail about Yahweh, even using Yahweh's name and quoting things from the writings of Moses as far as describing him. Having been schooled probably in Canaanite religion, she's very able to switch over and identify Yahweh as being different than anything she's familiar with. So somehow she's got information. She's fairly a sharp woman, it would appear. She said, yes, the men, and again, thinking on her feet right here. Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they had come from. At dusk, when it was time to close the city gate, the men left. I don't know which way they went, meaning letting them assume which way they went. She knows exactly where the men are going to go after. They're going to go back towards the Jordan. But she says, I don't know which way they went. I don't know which way they went. Go after them quickly. You may catch up with them. In other words, oh, good thing you came right now. They just left before the gates were closed. And I don't know where they went, but I'm assuming you're going to go towards the Jordan. Quick, if you hurry, you can probably catch them. I mean, it's really brilliant. It's a brilliant job of storytelling. Of fabricating a story. Verse 6, but she had taken them up to the roof and hidden them under the stalks of flax. We'll talk about that. She had laid out on the roof, so which fits perfectly with where the flax should be. So the men set out in pursuit of the spies on the road that leads to the fords of the Jordan. The fords is the narrowest part of the Jordan where the people could cross. And so that they went right. There's only one place they could have crossed. That's right here. So they head right to that place. And Rahab knew that's where they would have gone. Before the spies lay down for the night, she went up on the roof and said to them, again, they haven't gone to sleep yet. They're still in hiding. I know that the Lord, and there you can see it's capitalized in the NIV, L-O-R-D, capitalized, which means that is the translation of the word Yahweh, which is used by Rahab. I know that Yahweh has given the, not just God some, fabricated, random Elohim or El, but Yahweh has given this land to you. Now, how does she know that? Well, I mean, that's the Abrahamic covenant from 400 years before. I mean, is it possible that people knew of the Abrahamic covenant, that that's what Abraham was there for? Melchizedek, it may have been handed down. She also may have heard something from the wilderness. I mean, it seems like it's general information. The Lord has given you this land to you, and that a great fear of you has fallen on us. Again, this gives a little bit of historical background, meaning if they actually did to Egypt what happened to Egypt, the 10 plagues Yahweh did 40 years before, that would have devastated. In fact, it would have ended the dynasty, and things would have fallen apart in Egypt because of it. So these people, the king of Jericho is the king of the city-state, the area, Jericho and the area around him. But he's not a sovereign king. The kings that were over there, there's going to be a king of Jerusalem. There's going to be kings of these other cities we're going to see. But they were not like, they're independent city-states, but they're also overseen by not an emperor, but like an emperor, like it'd be Pharaoh. Pharaoh is the one who controls the land of Canaan up until the time of the Exodus, when they were devastated by the plagues and they lost control of this area because they're so weak. Otherwise, they controlled it. Thutmose III had gone up and had battles and controlled it. But with this event, things began to deteriorate. And we can see that as we look throughout history. It says, so everybody's afraid. A great fear of you has fallen on us, so that all who live in this country are melting in fear. Now, we're going to hear the same report in chapter 9 with the Gibeonites. The Gibeonites have also heard. That's why they come and they make a treaty. They take an oath with Joshua and his people because they know these things. It's melting with fear because of you. We have heard how the Lord, how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to Shihon and Og. Now, that's just recent history. That's, they probably could have watched the smoke of the battles looking across the Jordan. We've heard, we watched, we saw you come up the other side of the Jordan. The two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, whom you completely destroyed. When we heard of it, our hearts melted. They came out of Egypt. Now they've come up the east side. They're right across of us, 7 miles across the Jordan, whatever distance it is to the Jordan, which is, you can see the Jordan from Jericho, and then 7 more miles. So we're talking, 15 miles. They're 15 miles away. Whom you completely destroyed. When we heard of it, our hearts melted, and everyone's courage failed because of you. In other words, the courage we had, it no longer was kicking in. We did not have any source of confidence. For the Lord, Yahweh, your God, now here's a confession, we'll look at this again, her terms right here are right out of Moses' writings. And it's a phrase that's only used 3 times before this point right here. And she nails it. She says, for Yahweh, your Elohim, is El in heaven above and on earth below. Now then, please swear to me, take an oath, and they take oaths seriously, a promise, by the Lord, by your God, by Yahweh, that you will show kindness, and that word kindness is, again, hasid, it's that covenant faithfulness. You're going to make a covenant with me, and we're going to show covenant faithfulness to each other, show hasid to my family, because I have shown kindness to you. I have, in a sense, began a covenant with you by breaking my covenant with the king of Jericho. I've now made a covenant with you if you're willing to get in on the covenant with me. She's made allegiance to Yahweh by breaking allegiance with the king of Jericho and his reign, his dynasty, his religion. Now, make a covenant back with me. Give me a sure sign that you will spare the lives of my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and that you will save us from death. And again, so she calls her whole family into this. Now, are they believers also? Maybe so, maybe not, but she's bringing them into the contract. That the spies say, our lives for your lives. In other words, you spare us, we'll spare you. In other words, they accept the treaty. The men assured her, if you don't tell what we are doing, we will treat you kindly and faithfully when the Lord, when Yahweh gives us the land. So she let them down by a rope through the window, for the house she lived in was part of the city wall. Now your translations will be interesting how that's translated. Her house was in the wall. It was on the wall. It's the preposition. It's the preposition that means in. It can be translated on. The wall. The NIV goes safe. It says, for the house she lived in was part of the city wall, which is probably Akron. I can show you pictures. Now she had said to them at a previous point, go to the hills, which is to the west, so the pursuers will not find you, because they're probably going to go to the Jordan. Hide yourselves there for 3 days until they return, and then go on your way. And it's all going to match up perfectly with Joshua getting to the Jordan River with his party and the spies going back across. The men said to her, this oath you made us swear will not be binding on us unless when we enter the land you have tied this scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down. Unless you have brought your father and mother, your brother and your family into the house. Now notice what it says right here. They switch. I'll point this out when we go through the notes. But they're going to be let down by a rope, but then they're going to tell her to tie this scarlet cord. It's a different word. It's not the same thing. Rope and cord are not the same thing. It's this. It's some. They pick it up. It's something else. And then it says, through which you let us down. It doesn't say the rope you let us down with, but hang it in the window. You're going to let us out with this rope, but now in this same window we came out of, so we know which house is yours, hang this scarlet cord. So you've got a rope. The similarity is the same window. Now you're going to hang the scarlet cord in the window. And we'll mention that again. What could that mean? If anyone goes outside your house into the street, his blood will be on his own head. In other words, they've got to, in a sense, they've got to prove that they're part of the covenant. They've got to stay here and trust you and your oath and our covenant. If they go outside, there's an indication they're not part of the covenant. They're not part of the deal. Similar to like the blood on the doorpost or whatever. That's your sign that you're in the covenant. You're in the deal. If you go, if you don't do it, it indicates you're not taking this serious. And again, I guess, you know, I said that she's bringing them all in. If they're willing to listen to her testimony, here comes the Israelites. They're going to take our city. But if you come into my house, you'll be safe because Yahweh, and there's going to be, you know, some, they've got to have some kind of trust in her and her testimony to actually trust her Lord, the people of the Lord, and stay in the house. You understand what's, so in other words, their coming in and staying in the house would be an indication of their faith at some level in this Yahweh who's coming with his people. If they leave the house, join in the battle, or run somewhere for help, maybe to the temple or some other god, it indicates you didn't take the covenant serious. So anyone that stays in the house would be an indication you believe this covenant, you believe in this God, in Yahweh. As for anyone who is in the house with you, his blood will be on our head if a hand is laid on him. But if you tell what we are doing, we will be released from the oath you made us swear. In other words, if you go back to the other side, you will have shown, indicated that you had faith, but you really didn't. You're betraying us, and then we will wipe you all out. Agreed, she replied. Let it be as you say. So she sent them away, and they departed, and she tied the scarlet cord in the window. So again, right there, if it was the rope, it's already there. They leave down the rope, and then she ties the scarlet cord. When they left, they went into the hills to the west, instead of going back to the Jordan to the east, and stayed there 3 days until the pursuers had searched all along the road and returned without finding them. Then the two men started back. They went down out of the hills, forded the river, meaning they found the narrow spot of the river they could walk across, and came to Joshua, son of Nun, and told him everything that had happened to them. They said to Joshua, "The Lord has surely given the whole land into our hands. All the people are melting in fear because of us." Now, what has taken place there is, why did Joshua send spies? One of the first lessons you can see is Joshua has been told the land is yours, just trust God and do this. But yet Joshua sends spies. In other words, he sends someone in to check it out. There doesn't seem to be any condemnation of having received the promise of God, trusting God, but then taking some kind of practical action of checking out the land. And what Joshua does get out of it is confirmation. When he comes back, he says, not only have we heard the promise that the land is ours, they also know the land is ours, and they are afraid. And it's similar to what Gideon is going to hear when he goes down to the camp and hears the men talking, that the people are already prepared and are afraid of you. Now, on the notes here, I've got some interesting things that I find interesting. I hope you do also. What you're looking at there, a couple of these pictures are not my pictures. The rest of them are my pictures. This first one is not my picture. This is a picture of this place right here of Shittim, or Tal El Hamam. You can see that's the source right there where I got this. That's on the other side of the Jordan. It's 7 miles from. It's part of what Genesis calls the Kakar. We've talked about this before. The disc. It's this disc. Kakar means the disc shaped right here. And it is what Moses or Abraham looked down. It's where Lot looked down. It's where Sodom was located. It was very watered. All the water ran down from the hills, especially in Jordan, ran down from the mountains down here, a well-watered area. And that was a place earlier in Genesis. That's the remains. It's a huge, huge tell. It's the largest tell in the land of Jordan. Tell meaning remains of a civilization. It's got several layers built up through it, but there's a 600-year dead space where nothing exists from the time of Abraham until 600 years later when civilization during the Iron Age began to come back into it. Nonetheless, this is what it says right here. This is a quote taken from this biblical archaeology site. Tal El Hamam, located 8 miles northeast of the mouth of the Jordan, so right here, 8 miles from here, 7 miles from the Jordan, was one of the largest Bronze Age cities in the South Levant. Now, Bronze Age is the time of Abraham, Joseph, in that time. We're at the end of the Bronze Age, beginning to enter into the Iron Age. Judges is the end of the Bronze Age, beginning of the Iron Age, if you care. This place anchored a major city-state that is likely identified in the Bible as the cities of the plain, referred to as Kakar. Now, what I'm reading right here is right out of biblical archaeology. It's a quote I just took out of there. In Genesis 13 through 19, I pointed that out. Hamam is a perfect match for Sodom itself. If you read the word, it should be located at the time. This is a perfect match, biblical archaeology. And Steve Collins is over there excavating it right now. In fact, the next picture is Steve Collins' picture from this Saturday in Tal el Hamam. Watch this. Hamam is perfectly matched for Sodom itself, along with its extensive megalithic field of stone circles. That's going back to the ancient times, like Neolithic. Menhirs, dolmens, those are all things that are stood up from the ancient times. The landscape of Tal el Hamam has also been identified as this, Abel Mizraim. That's in Genesis 50:11. When Joseph comes up to bury Jacob, they pass by this place. It was called Abel Mizraim at that time. And Abel Shittim, right here, this is it right here, the final camping sites of Moses and the Israelites before they crossed into Canaan, Numbers 33:49. Now, that is part of the quote I took out of biblical archaeology, that this was Moses' final place. Now, Steve Collins, in excavating it, found a place that was on the top from the time of this period that had been built up on top of it, and it was a house that had been deserted or some buildings that had been deserted that was occupied probably by Moses and then by Joshua. And then when they leave, when they began their, as someone, when they got done with it, they didn't just leave it. They torched the whole place and then left at that layer in the excavation. And Steve Collins has identified that and points that out, that at a higher level than Sodom, something else was built that was then torched, and then the place was abandoned, which matches perfectly with the arrival of Moses and Joshua and the Israelites from their camp. That's where they would have sent the spies out. That's where Joshua camped. And then at this time, they would have just burnt that place or that area, and it would have just been covered up then, because the Iron Age is going to build on it. I fortunately have a pot handle from this very location, from the Iron Age, which would be around 1000 BC, David's time period, that was taken from this site. They had many, many things that had been found there, and one of the archaeologists brought it over, and I got it, which is just like a gift, which was fine. Okay, now, the next picture on the bottom of page one is that very site, and they've gone through the Iron Age, down through the early or late bronze, middle bronze, down into, that's all those layers that are there. Those are different buildings, all built on top of each other, and a lot of times stones have been reused. And this is interesting. They found bones on Saturday, February 29th, 2020, in the Middle Bronze Age stratification in the Palace of Tal el Hamam, which would be the palace of Sodom at that time period. This was just Saturday. This was an email. Or the ancient Sodom of the destruction level. And then Steve Collins writes, I clarified a nicely made mud brick wall in the Middle Bronze Age palace complex, southwest extremity in square. And then the different excavation squares are numbered because they're very scientific about the layers they go through. They find burn layers and destruction layers and different things. Then as we were going down into the destruction matrix, meaning there was an explosion that blew things a certain direction, and they're in that destruction layer where everything is just burnt and blown across the matrix next to the wall, they made a grisly discovery, scattered human bone fragments, including significant portions of two skulls. One skull has all but the lower jaw. The other has the full upper dentition with bone up to half of the right eye socket. Next to the larger skull fragment was a half a pelvis and a partial arm bone. So in other words, this would have been that explosion that blew. We talked last week, I don't know if it was Tuesday night, where the explosion came. It was an air burst. Scientists are looking at this. There was an air burst that blew up this way and blew the water right out of the Dead Sea. Besides the destruction of the heat, the whole area here was covered with salt water that killed this area, this Kirkar, the fertile plains, for 600 years. They couldn't grow anything. It's like pouring salt on it from the Dead Sea. And that's the destruction layer he's talking about. Other human bone fragments have been encountered throughout the entire depth of the destruction matrix. Essentially, these bodies have been ripped to pieces and churned into the middle bronze 2 terminal destruction matrix. In other words, all the household goods and everything that was there just and blew it this direction and just smashed it against the wall. And these remains, they're finding these as they're excavating through, at this point, the palace at that time. And then he goes, sorry, we can't show any pics until before it's published. And they've got to publish their work. Now, here is, again, a map on page 2. As you see, the circle is the Kakar. That is the disc. That's the word used in Genesis. And you can see Jericho. And if you look at number 8, the dots on, that's the plain, the cities of the plain. That's where Lot chose to go. It was the good land, and indeed it was. But number 8 is Tel El Hamam. So you can see that's where Joshua would have been. That's where Moses would have been. It's called Shittim in our story today. It's Tel El Hamam. Tel means tell. It means it's a ruins of a society. It's another way over here on this side of the Jordan, they call them tells. Over here it's spelled tall because of the language, Arabic or Hebrew or what the background is. So that's what that's referring to. Anyway, you can just see. So that's where we're at. Turn the page. Now, here's another map. You can see there's a dot right there. The pin is at Abel Shittim, which is this place right here, Tel Hamam. And most people agree it's all the same place. That's where they're at. You can see Gilgal. They got a question by Gilgal because Gilgal is going to be a campsite. Gilgal, it means it's the circle of the stones. And so it's going to be an actual location, but it's going to probably, especially when we go through Hosea, it's mentioned in Hosea as we're going through on Tuesday nights, it probably becomes an outdoor sanctuary. And the stones that Joshua is going to pick up and carry off the Jordan, they're going to put those in a circle. Notice how close it probably is to Jericho. That's where the camp is going to go, at Gilgal, outside of Jericho. And it's going to be remain there and be built upon in the future generations until the days of Hosea in the 700 BCs. It's completely corrupted now. The place where they were first circumcised, where they celebrated the first Passover in the land, it is completely corrupted by pagan religions or the Canaanite religions, and God is even saying, stop going to Gilgal. It was a place where Joshua would always return to. The people are in the book of Joshua, they're going to go to Gilgal. They're going to regroup at Gilgal. That's the stones. You can see the stones we picked up. It's a place of worship, the place they were circumcised and they crossed the Jordan, the place they celebrated the first Passover. It was a holy site. It was kind of like our place to get with the Lord and get focused before we went back to the next battle. And so that's where they're heading. They're heading towards Gilgal. And then from there, Joshua's going to go himself and kind of take a look at Jericho, and the angel of the Lord will meet him there. Again, remember, Gilgal is going to become a corrupt place. The next map is one of my maps that I made. Joshua's entrance campaign from Shittim, going across the Jordan to Gilgal, and then coming down and attacking Jericho. And then you're going to see, we know the story, he's going to go to Ai. That's in right there south. East of Beth Avon or Bethel, house of wickedness or house of God. And then the central campaign is going to be Gibeon, Jarmuth, Libna, Lachish, Eglon, Hebron, all the way down to Debir. And we'll look at that as we go. Then they're going to go up and recommit to the covenant between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. We've also got pictures of that and the standing pillars there. But that's kind of where we're heading at right now. We got the entrance campaign. Now turn the page. There's my map from Galen Games from the 1980s. I just put that in there quick. And then here's a picture I took from the wilderness, the Judean wilderness. And you can see I'm standing in the wilderness. Now, if you left Jerusalem, here's Jerusalem. And just east of Jerusalem is Mount Olives right here. And then there's a city, some little cities on the backside of the Mount of Olives. But if you get too far out here, say you go 10 miles this direction, you're in the wilderness. In fact, the Kidron Valley that runs right here runs and turns this way and runs right into the wilderness because it drains, all the water's going to drain into the Dead Sea. This is wilderness. I mean, the barren land. I mean, just sand and mounds of sand. And so when Jesus was on Gethsemane, he could have just turned and walked this way and then back in the wilderness where he'd spent 48 days in the wilderness of Judea. Well, anyway, in that wilderness, you can continue in that wilderness, and we've driven through it a couple of times. It just keeps going down, 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 because this Jerusalem is on a mountain. I mean, not like a snow peak mountain, but it's in the ridge. It's at the high point. Going this way, it starts going into the hill country and down to the Mediterranean coast, the coastal plain. Then you come up through the hill country, up to the mountain, the main ridge. Then at Jerusalem, then you go start going this way. You start going down, down, down to the Dead Sea, which is the lowest place on earth. So you can imagine the steep decline going down this way. And this is all wilderness country right here. And that's where I'm standing in this picture. I'm standing right here looking to the east, this direction. And you can see that grove of trees. I've got it labeled Jericho. There's a natural spring there. Elisha's spring, they call it. Elisha went there and purified it. But it's been there since the beginning of time because there's always water coming up there. I actually drank from it, meaning it's fresh water, and you can go down there, you can take some water and just drink out of it. And I did that, and then I thought, how smart was that? And I was still alive 3-4 days later. I thought, okay, I'm going to live through this. But I did drink right out of that, right out of the spring of water coming up out of the ground in 2012. I mean, what was in it, it didn't kill me. But anyway, it was one of the things I'm glad I did. I'm glad I didn't think about it. Because if I would have thought about it, I would have thought, I'll just take a picture. But I took a picture and took a drink. But nonetheless, that's that green. That's going to be green. That's all. I'll show you some more pictures. That's Jericho. Then you can't see it real clear, but I've got it labeled. That's the Jordan River going right across there. So you're in the wilderness of Judea looking over Jericho, seeing the Jordan River, looking into the land of Jordan. And we're very, very close to doing exactly what Abraham did of standing here at Bethel right here and looking this way and being able to see the good land right here. Just that's exactly what Lot would have been looking at. I'm just a little bit lower this way, east of Jerusalem, instead of being a little bit north of Bethel. Anyway, that's interesting. Because you can see, that's where Joshua is right now, over where that dot is, the country of Jordan. He's in that area. And if they were camping, you'd be able to probably see people there. And they're going to come up to the Jordan River, cross the Jordan River, and camp at Gilgal, which would maybe be somewhere where it says Jordan River, the words like between the D, A, N, and the R. That's probably somewhere where Gilgal would be. Again, we don't know the location. It's probably an outdoor sanctuary, the Circle of Stones, and that was 3,000 years ago. But you can see Jericho very clearly. Okay, turn the page. There's a picture of the Jordan River. That's a picture of the Jordan River in June. The flood stage would have been more like February, March, when Joshua's coming across. So that's the Jordan River, or part of the Jordan River. The next picture at the bottom is I'm standing on the top of the Tell of Jericho. Remember that the tree formation I saw in the picture before right here, this one? Now I'm standing in the middle of that. You can see all the palm trees. Now all around there is wilderness, desert. But notice, there's palm trees. There's green. It's the most amazing thing. You just drive through all this wilderness, and all of a sudden you come up, and there's palm trees. I mean, there's green yards. It's a beautiful place. And I'm standing on the Tell of Jericho. There are parts of it have been excavated. And now I'm still looking east. I'm looking over. If I had a better, clearer picture, you could see the Jordan River looking into Jordan. So I'm standing right there in Jericho at that time. Turn the page. On page 6. Now, on part of that, here's what we've got right here. There is the wall. Now, remember, the walls are going to collapse. The walls are going to fall. What we have right here that still is standing is the base of what is the retaining wall. Think of a yard work where you've got a retaining wall holding up the dirt, holding the yard up. That's the retaining wall. It is not the wall. It's the base of which the wall is going to be built on. On top of that wall would have been a high mud brick wall. maybe a casement wall, most likely. A casement wall would be something like this. Here's the rock wall that you see, the retaining wall, holding up, you know, what's inside of here, and here's outside the wall. On top of that would have been mud bricks like this, a mud brick wall like that. We're looking at a layer. And then another one here would have been two walls built up, and then fill would have been put in here. Dirt, rocks, whatever, just fill would have been put there. So you've got a double, and there would have been supports going across there. That's called a casement wall. So instead of just having a mud brick wall here and a mud brick wall there, you'd have two of them, and then they'd be filled in. And you can see examples of this throughout excavations of a casement wall built up on there. And so when the walls fell, these mud bricks are the things that collapsed. This is what collapsed. And they didn't collapse because they were beaten down. Like when Nebuchadnezzar came into Jericho, he broke through the wall or broke through the gates. This just is going to fall. It's just going to collapse. And people are going to come up over, stepping up over and go up over the mud bricks. So that's why that wall is still standing there, because it's not the wall, it's the retaining wall. Now, outside of that wall, if you look to the right, you can see the tell going up. Also, if you look at that top picture on page 6, if you look in the background, now we're standing right about here in Jericho. See, right about here in Jericho, looking this way. And what you can see in the background is what? You can see hills. You can see the mountains back in here that we just came down out of. To my back there, back this way, would be the Jordan. So I'm standing here looking this way at that wall. And then you can see the hills. That's the hills that the spies are going to go to. Rahab's going to let them out and send them to the hills. Now, down there in that same top picture on page 6 to the right, it says remains of residences built up against the city wall. And so right there, you can see the remains of the retaining wall, but then you can see the walls of these residences would be higher. This is just the bottom stones. That's what's left up. And the bottom picture now, you can see where I've got a little arrow there pointing there to the retaining wall. That's the stones in the back of that second picture on the bottom of page 6. And then you can see a mud brick wall of a home that's attached to the city wall. That's what we're pointing at to the left in the top picture above it. Is now I've got a picture, and you can clearly see the mud bricks from, you know, 1400 BC. You can clearly see the mud bricks in that city, in that residence. So two options here of Rahab's house is Rahab's house could have been in the wall. Between the casement walls, there could have been space in between here that they could have built houses and things like that. That's one way of interpreting it. It was in the wall. Or it was on the wall. This is the retaining wall. And what you're seeing right there is the lower parts of the houses, residents, not just hers, but the residences that would have been built up with mud bricks outside here attached to the retaining wall and the wall of the city. So she would have lived out here, been part of the city, but living outside of the walls, which would make sense. That's why, you know, the spies would have been involved in that or somehow in that situation. Again, somehow either they're in here or they're attached to the wall here, and then there'd be gates somewhere outside of that protecting the city. But anyway, those are mud bricks that are there today that you can still see. Turn the page. There's a part of a structure. You can still see the retaining wall in the background there. And that's some kind of a structure, the walls or the base of the walls, a 3,500-year-old structure that's attached to the retaining wall. Turn the page again, page 8. There, you can see to the left of that picture, you can see some of the residences. That's outside, out here. And then you can see me standing on the retaining wall. Me standing right where the walls used to be, the mud brick walls. I'm standing on there while Tony takes a picture of the man standing on the walls of Jericho. That's 2007, right there. With my Indiana Jones hat that my boys got for me for Father's Day many years ago. And I wore it to Jerusalem every time. Okay, there, that's me. Okay, then you got the next picture at the bottom of page 8. Now I'm stepping up, back up on the tell, looking over that wall, looking towards the city of Jericho today, which is still there. You can see we're on the ancient remains of a tell, but over there going towards the Jordan, you can still see the place. It's still beautiful. There's still water there. It's not like they're trying to keep the city alive by irrigating a bunch of water in. There's still a natural spring there. So look at the palm trees. They didn't ship those in. You know what Jericho means? It's also called the City of Palms. In the book of Judges, it's called the City of Palms. And so why would they call that? Well, there's still palms there today, which is interesting. Okay, page 9, there's a pool of water right outside the tell from the spring of Elijah spring that's been there since the dawn of time, as far as we can tell. It's still pumping water out of the ground today. And then there, now the bottom picture, page 9, is Jericho, again, the tell. You can see how large it is. You can see how much has not been excavated. They've excavated enough to get the different layers and different time periods and found some things out. They found the retaining wall. They found the mud brick walls. But there's a whole lot there that, you know, if you're treasure hunting, just take a bulldozer, go through there and just start bulldozing and sifting through stuff trying to find anything that was left. Nonetheless, that is what you have there. So some pictures of what's taking place. Now to walk through this story one more time, I've got some notes. And as we read through this, at the top of page 1, it says, Rahab's house was an inn, a tavern, and a logical place for travelers, and in this case, spies. So when she's a prostitute, and the way it worked in those days, if you had an inn, you'd provide services. You could have a place to stay, you could have a tavern, you could have the prostitute. This was the place of, it was a money-making operation, a family organization. I mean, remember, it's like, well, that's not decent. Right, we're in Canaan, okay? We're in the land. They're coming to destroy the land of Canaan because of the wickedness. So it's like, I don't know if that would be the case. Okay, well, read Leviticus and when they talk about the Canaanites. So there's no doubt that that could be the situation. Rahab's house would have been a source of information because everybody's coming and going. Travelers were coming and going. And a great place for cover, or so the spies thought. Because we just kind of mix in with all the other travelers. The people are moving towards the Jordan in 3 days. I mentioned this. The spies leave Moses and arrive at Jericho the same day. They spend the night and then they go to the hills and then get back by the third day. While as Joshua is leaving, here's the Jordan again. He's leaving Shittim right here. He's going this way. The spies were in Jericho. Now they're over here hiding. They're going to make their way back and ford the Jordan and meet Joshua right here and come across with the people. It would seem to be the case. The road going from Jericho down to the fording, wherever the fording would be done at, they've checked that whole road, can't find them. They come back, the spies slip by, and again, the whole story is kind of amazing, and it all kind of fits together. Chapter 2, verse 2, Jericho would have had a king, a leader of the city-state. I mentioned that. He would have been answerable to a higher authority, maybe in Egypt. The spies are detected. Interesting, chapter 2, verse 4, Rahab knows why the spies are there. She hides them before the king comes looking. Also, the flax in chapter 2, verse 6. Let's read this here again, chapter 2, verse 6. So what we just said, the spies, the Joshua son of Nun secretly sent 2 spies from Shittim. You see that? Go look over the land, he said, especially Jericho. That's where they go. So they went and entered the house of a prostitute. The footnote here possibly could also mean innkeeper. In my NIV, you may have a different translation than prostitute. But again, sometimes those words, they if you were an innkeeper, it meant you also were providing full hospitality. I mean, from food, the tavern, place to sleep, and prostitutes. I mean, it's part of the package. So it's that word can go back or forth. Named Rahab. Again, Rahab is going to be it's going to be mentioned later here in the notes, but she's one of 4 women mentioned in Jesus' genealogy. She is in Jesus' genealogy. If we could do this off the top of my head, it's on your notes. You've got Rahab, who's a Canaanite. Oh, we've already got Tamar, who is going to be Jacob's daughter-in-law, who marries Judah, who then... Is I'm telling this correctly? You get this mixed up. She's going to end up marrying. Judah's. Okay, now that I've got into this, you guys know the story what I'm talking about. Okay, I'm going to go to Genesis. I did this wrong a couple weeks ago. A couple months. Yeah, Judah, chapter 38 of Genesis. After that time, Judah left his brothers and went down and stayed in the land of Adullam. I'm in Genesis 38. Judah got a wife for Ur. Oh, okay, right. It's not Jacob, it's Judah. Okay, that's what I always get mixed up. This is Jacob's son's daughter-in-law. Yeah, so it'd be Jacob's grandson that she married and twice and they died. Anyway, she's a Canaanite. She's involved in Jesus' genealogy. Then there's going to be Bathsheba. And I just skipped another one. These are out of order. Bathsheba, she's going to be a Hittite, apparently. And then there's going to be Ruth, who is a Moabite. So Tamar would be the first one, Rahab the second one, Ruth the third one, and then Bathsheba the fourth one are all Gentile women that are in Jesus' genealogy. And right here we've got Rahab being mentioned here. So again, she is a woman of faith, as all these women were, but they were Gentiles, and they're in Jesus' genealogy. Verse 4, but the woman had taken the two spies and hid them. She said, yes, the men came here. Okay, verse 6. But she had taken them up to the roof and hidden them under the stalks of flax she had laid out on the roof. And what the flax is happening here is this. And on the notes there on number 2, verse 6, the Gezer calendar, which was a calendar that was found at Gezer, which is further this way, from 900 B.C., it's got a little calendar on it. And it says that flax on that calendar, like flax was harvested then on that calendar in February or March, or February, March, right in that month there when they're combined. And studies show that the Jordan Valley, this is the Jordan Valley right here, irrigated fields as early as 1200 B.C., they've got proof of this, that they irrigated fields and raised flax. Now, the flax seeds were then are used to create linseed oil, but the fibers that were produced would be turned into yarn. And the yarn was made soft by soaking the fibers and then drying them on a roof and letting them bleach, getting them dried and bleached. And then they would take and crush them, beat them together, and spun them into yarn. And so the fact that there's flax on Rahab's roof, it's there. She's making material to be bleached by the sun, dried out after it's been stretched out, and then crushed it and put it together to make yarn. That's what's taking place there. It matches the time of the season. It matches the practice of the culture. And so there's that's what the flax is being used for right there. Chapter 2, verse 7, the logical place to pursue spies. We'll be back to the Jordan, so she sends them there. We mentioned, we go back and read through that again, all the different points of how brilliant she was in playing the game of deception. James is even, and this comes up as a question, and it's a fair question, is, well, she's lying. Isn't lying a sin? And I think the issue right here is, yes, deception is a sin, but right here, is she going to protect the truth, or is she going to defend the lie, which is the false religion? And in this case right here, to defend the truth, she's going to have to not side with the lie and defend the truth. She's going to have to mislead the lie. So you can see how that makes sense. And people say, well, that you should never lie. Well, in this case right here, there's something bigger than, you know, those little moral behaviors, and that is Yahweh. Again, I don't want to say little moral behaviors, but faithfulness to Yahweh is of utmost importance. And if that's the priority, even like a father being faithful to his family, should you deny the Lord to help serve your family? Well, if it comes to serving your family or being faithful to the Lord, which one's right? You can't deny the Lord and serve your family, say, I did a noble thing. You're going to have to confess Yahweh. And it's one of those things, is which one's the greater value. Even James says her action, the book of James, and you know this, James is talking about deeds proving your faith. You don't just say, I've got faith, show me your deeds. If you've got faith in your heart, this goes back to Hosea that we talked about last week, if you've got faith in your hearts, I don't need you to tell me about the faith, I can see your faith by your deeds. Like in just the opposite, in Samaria, in Israel, in the north, is they've got deeds, but they've got whoredom in their hearts, which means their deeds reveal the whoredom in their hearts. And once he sees what's in their hearts, he realizes there's no hope for them. It's not like you just made one mistake. You've got complete corruption. And when he sees this, this complete darkness, he's done. He goes away. He leaves you to your destruction. If your deeds, in her case, her deeds were a reflection of her faith. That's exactly what James says. So in other words, basically, her deception, her deceiving evil was a good deed produced by her faith, and she's commended for her deed of deception, siding with the truth where she had faith in the truth, and she deceived the deception with deception. And again, some people want to argue about that. You can find apologetics making comments about that, and there's probably a more elegant way of answering that question. But again, that's the answer for that. So again, she's commended for her faith, even in the New Testament and throughout. That's why her story is told right here. Chapter 2, verse 9 on page 10. Rahab's confession here is the first of the Canaanites to convert. You have a Canaanite, and this is interesting. You've got a Canaanite who's been handed over to destruction. All the Canaanites are to be destroyed. But here's the first Canaanite we encounter, and what don't we do to her? We don't destroy her. We convert her. It's like she says, oh, we know you're coming. I'm going to side with you. I'm going to break my covenant, my treaty with my people and deceive them and help you and make an oath, a covenant with you and join with you. And so she's a convert because she's heard of Yahweh. She knows of Yahweh. And instead of being destroyed by Yahweh, she converts, which is, again, amazing that Yahweh is not this hard, crusty figure that can't offer grace or mercy or repentance. She's converted. In fact, if her household, again, it's not a guarantee that her parents and her brothers and her uncles and aunts are all going to say, yeah, what a great idea. Let's rebel against the king of Jericho and the Pharaoh that oversees him and come hide in your house. Like, that's a stupid idea. Just talk politics to your relatives and see if they're going to join with you. But nonetheless, they may have said, that's dumb. We're not going to join. But she gave them the offer. Do you want to come join me and be protected by Yahweh and his people? Or do you want to stay with your deception? And the very fact that they came into the house, they weren't forced into her house. It's possible that some of her family stayed in the streets and perished in the destruction. But those that came with her would have shown some kind of faith in Yahweh and the covenant and the promise and the details of what was going on historically in front of their eyes. So she's the first. Could all of Jericho have been saved? I think we can push this, that it's possible that the king could have met her and says, is this a chance? Can we talk to these people? Is there a chance that we can convert and let them take the land, but we will accept their God? I think he could have. Name a group that did that. The Gibeonites. Now, they weren't honest about it. They're like, they came, they just knew we're dead. They've got the truth. They weren't sure if they could trust Joshua. They didn't know the character of Yahweh that they could have. But they did know enough to say, we know you're going to take the land, but we're from far, far away. Can we make a covenant? Oh, yeah, sure, we'll make a covenant. Joshua was misled. But again, the Gibeonites are going to have the same kind of faith that Rahab has, and they're going to try to figure out some way to, you know, finagle themselves into this deal. And indeed they did. And notice, even though Joshua was misled, the very fact that he took an oath, and this kind of goes to show you what's taking place here when Rahab makes the men swear, how does she know they're not going to betray her? You've just taken an oath in the name of your God, Yahweh. Now, in our culture, I mean, people lie, deceive. I mean, we got politicians using Jesus' name and Christianity, whatever is convenient. But in these days, they believed in Yahweh, or they believed in Baal. They believed in El. They believed in the God. And if you took an oath in your God's name, you weren't afraid of the people coming back and getting you. It was like you actually believed this God was involved in history. And she knew these guys were not going to take an oath in Yahweh's name and then break it, because I'm not going to have to come kill you. Yahweh's going to do it. That's why Gideon changes his name to Jerubbaal. Remember that story? When Gideon tears down the altar of Baal, and they find out who did it, they wanted to kill him, but Gideon's dad was one of the priests of Baal, and he has a great idea. He says, hey, don't fight Baal's battle. Let Baal deal with my son. If Baal's upset, which I'm sure he is, he'll take care of him. Let's watch our God kill my son. And so Gideon goes, all right, bring it on. And he switched his name from, so they started calling him Jerubbaal, which means Baal contends, meaning Baal is going to kick your butt, in a loose translation. And so what Gideon began to do is call himself, guess what? Who are you? I'm Jerubbaal. Oh, you're the one Baal's going to kill. Yeah. Ooh, how much time you got left? That's been 25 years so far. Doesn't seem like it's a big deal to Baal. In other words, Baal is so weak that I violated him, and he can't do anything about it. And so they actually backed off killing Gideon because they thought Baal's going to do it. So right here, when the men swear an oath in Yahweh's name, they take it serious. Just like Joshua, when he took an oath with the Gibeonites, he was deceived, but I took an oath in my God's name. I have to follow through with this. So that's a big deal going on here, and Rahab is playing into that. Okay, you've got the third bullet point under point 2.9. There you've got Rahab's confessed these things. She's going to confess, and this is pretty impressive. She's going to confess, Israel's God has dominion over heaven and earth. She had been trained by the Canaanite religion with their many gods, but here Rahab recites Israelite doctrine. He's the God of the heavens and the earth. She uses Yahweh's name. Yahweh is the only God, and she uses the name Yahweh, not Baal, Asherah, Marduk, or Ishtar. She calls him Yahweh. She doesn't confuse him with any of the other gods. She knows those are those gods, but this is the only God. Now, it'd be good for the Israelites to be able to do that. In the book of Hosea, the Israelites can't do that. They don't know the difference. Rahab is ahead of the Israelites of the 700s B.C., and then Rahab's statement, and I've already mentioned this, quote, in the heavens above and the earth below has only appeared three times in Exodus 20, Deuteronomy 4, and Deuteronomy 5, and all those times about him being like the sole God. So Rahab knew intimate knowledge and specific language from the writings of Moses while inside Jericho. Did she get this from travelers? Had it been broadcast from the wilderness? And again, people coming and reporting it. Is it left over from the days of Abraham? But she knows who Yahweh is, and she's willing to turn against her culture and join with Yahweh. Rahab, a Canaanite, there you got the first of the four women, besides Mary. Mary was not a Canaanite, a Gentile, though. And then I say all Jericho had the opportunity to respond to Yahweh. Chapter 2, verse 12, here's that word kindness, hasid. It means kindness, mercy, steadfast love, loyalty, faithless, and she showed them kindness. Doesn't this mean she was nice? No, she was so kind. What a kind old prostitute. It was like, no, the kind, it meant she showed us faithless. She showed us loyalty. She was committed to us, making sure we are going to get the best. And so now she's saying, will you show me kindness? It's they're making an oath, and they consider it very seriously. Chapter 2, verse 15, that we talk about on the wall or in the wall. You can see the preposition is be with a hyphen that goes in front. That means in the wall or on the wall, and we talked about that. And there's the scarlet cord, chapter 2, verse 17. The spies used a rope, that's H-E-B-E-L, to escape. And then the Hebrew, this cord of scarlet thread is right there in the Hebrew. You can read that out. Basically, this cord is taqua. You got habel, the rope, taqua, this cord. And this cord could have been, it's something special. Not necessarily special, like this is my special cord, but it's something that was this, they picked it up. It was like I said right here, a cord the spies maybe brought it along. Maybe it's something we brought from the tabernacle, or something we brought that we used to tie our luggage together. It's our cord. You put this in the window, we know which one it is. That could have been what it means. Or it was something just laying around. You here, tie this scarlet cord in the window. Or it could have been something Rahab, maybe more likely, will know which house is yours if you hang out your advertisement. Your whatever to mark, which is the house that is the inn? Which is it? Oh, it's the one with the banner hanging out. Maybe it says Rahab's place, you know, whatever. Maybe it was an indication of that this was a place of lodging. But whatever it was this cord that was hung out. And then scarlet is the word S-A-N-I. It is used in the Bible to describe textiles that have been decorated for the tabernacle. It refers to like bright coats, like Joseph's coat had these bright colors in it, or special garments for the wealthy. So whatever this cord is, scarlet, it was something that was red, but it was dyed. It was something special, even wealthy. It was something special that when we see this hanging, again, it could have merely been an advertisement for Rahab's place. We'll know which place not to attack. And the people would have been in there, and it happens just like they said. And then as we read the end of this right here, I got to read the last verse, and then I'm done. Chapter 2, verse 24. They, after this experience, you know, they go hide, they cross the ford, they come back to Joshua. Joshua's there ready to cross the Jordan. They meet him, and they say, in verse 24 of chapter 2, the Lord Yahweh, or Yahweh, has surely given the whole land into our hands. All the people are melting in fear because of us. Now, how much more information they get? Besides, all we know is they talked to Rahab, but they appear to have made some other contacts. They've spied out the land, got caught, were observed by the king. They're moving out. They come back knowing we've got, they're talking about Yahweh. These people are talking about Yahweh. His reputation has preceded him into the land. This is, it's like, it's going to happen. And so it would have been confirmation for Joshua. As if he needs confirmation, he's got Moses, he's got the Lord speaking to him, he's got the Abrahamic covenant. Now the spies are coming and saying, this is a go, this is a go. So things are going to now begin to take place here. And that is the story of Joshua sending the spies, staying at Rahab's house. I'll pray and we're done. Father, we do thank you again for the chance to look into these things. We do ask that we would learn from these examples of being able to trust you, but also be able to use our own wisdom and experience and insight into situations. And Father, we ask again that we would be able to spread this truth and have confidence in your word, that it's not just random stories and legends, but that these are actual historical facts happening to real people as you were involved in their lives, just as you are in ours. As history continues to unfold, we ask that we would continue to see you working in our lives, in the history of our nation, and in the history of the church. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Hey, thank you for your time.